to All Together Now. This is Eleanor Lacaine. Every week on this show, I bring you people and programs that offer solutions to the many challenges we now face. Today's guest claims to have a solution to many problems through one proposal. He is proposing a new way to fund the government that would dramatically lighten the tax load on working people and generate an abundant stream of income to finance the many important programs in government. His plan is to eliminate the income tax and other taxes and pay for the federal government with a small tax every time money changes hands. His name is Scott Smith. He wrote up his amazing proposal in a recent book, The New Operating System for the American Economy. He has high-level experience in Wall Street as a pioneer of structured finance, where he helped to greatly reduce the cost of mortgages. He helped design the financing for Nelson Mandela's redevelopment program, providing low-cost housing for families throughout South Africa. He is the co-founder of two nationally acclaimed charter schools and the co-founder of the Foundation for a Better Economy. Scott Smith, welcome to All Together Now.
Hi, Eleanor. Thank you very much.
I was so excited to find out about your work, highly recommended by a close friend of mine, and then to meet you when you came to town last week. And I'm eager to share what I'm learning with our listeners here. So could you start us off with a very brief summary of what is your proposal?
Well, you've done such a good job of stating it yourself, Eleanor. I should be taking notes.
Thank you, but we still have an hour.
Well, to your point, what I started to do, this is something I've worked on for really around 20 years, and it occurred to me that we've got these problems in healthcare, in education. Poverty is a big problem. The high cost of taxes for people. I just kind of made a list. The deficit has always been a big concern to me.
Yep.
Growing debt, $22 trillion. I mean, that's been in the papers a lot. And I saw these problems as being neither a liberal issue or a conservative issue. Taking care of poverty was just as important as balancing the budget, just as important as paying off the debt. And I really didn't see that that the parties were advancing those issues. So I thought, first, let's find out what could be the best solution. What's the neatest, simplest, systemic solution? So I spent a lot of time on that, and of course that's a big debatable thing as to how to go about these. So I worked on that. And then I said, now how much would it cost to do this? And because I thought at the time, private sector's going to have to pay for some of it, the public sector some, and let's just get that total cost out there and figure out what it is. And it came, and that includes the cost of closing the deficit. Okay, so it includes mm-hmm. all those things, near and dear to both liberals and conservatives. It came to $10 trillion a year, and that was a completely overwhelming number.
So the $10 trillion a year would be the cost of funding all current government programs and paying off the debt. Is that right?
And providing things like basic income and health care and mm-hmm. college education for citizens is a long punch list. It was sort of like the, dream come true punch list. How much would it cost? And that's what the $10 trillion came to. And so to contrast that, what we're up against when you look at something like that is current federal spending is $4 trillion, and all state and local spending together is another $1 trillion. That's $5 trillion. And you can really begin to appreciate the gravity of the problem when you compare that to the income that we all earn. everybody's income in the United States totals about $16 trillion, a little more than that today, but call it $16 trillion. And so the first conclusion was that income tax was not the way to do it. And there was a little history behind that, because if you look at the history of our country, we'll settle on a tax base, and maybe 20 years will go by, and then there'll be a new tax base. Really, every couple of decades, as the economy has changed since the beginning of the country, we have switched the base to reflect the new economy that's in play.
Right. Well, and I just want to underscore one point you're making here, is that if the total of all the money earned, all the income in the country is $16 trillion a year, mm-hmm. and you're saying the cost to fund what we really need from government is $5 trillion, that would be a very heavy burden to pay, and if we're supposed to pay that $5 trillion out of the income taxes, that's like one-third of everything everyone earns would be going to fund the government, and that's just too onerous.
With the current projects, if you're going to start adding things in there, like a lot of people are talking about basic income.
Right.
You know the Social Security system is broken. It's a matter of time till that trust fund is depleted, and we're either going to have to raise FICA taxes or we're going to have to cut benefits for people who work for decades mm-hmm. and were promised they wouldn't have benefits cut. So you've got, when you add those other layers, you're adding them to the $5 trillion. And so it became clear that income tax was not sufficient, but so what else is there? That was the big question, and that's what led to the rather phenomenal answer. One of the what else is there, you can look at Bernie Sanders or AOC lately, and they're talking about a tax of 0.1% on the New York Stock Exchange. The New York Stock Exchange is around $75 trillion a year. But honestly, that's a challenge because it is really, criticism of that is a good criticism. If you have the choice of buying stock on any number of exchanges around the world, in Japan and London, Frankfurt and Germany, and they're not taxed, and New York Stock Exchange is taxed. Why, you can buy IBM stock wherever you want in the world. So that's...
You mean I could just call up the London Stock Exchange and say, I want to buy 100 shares of Apple, and they would sell it?
You would go to a broker that was seated on the London Stock Exchange, and you'd buy it through them. And by the way, that includes all the known names around here, the J.P. Morgans and Goldman Sachs, they all are associated with all of those exchanges. It's a global market, and really, $75 trillion in terms of what you're trying to capture, it wasn't sufficient. So, I took my cue really from nature, is what I'd like to say. I am a big fan of systems in nature and how they work. And so you've got the water cycle out there. And the amount of rain that falls in our country or falls globally is enormous, And so you look at what nature's trying to solve there is, well, how do you get all that water up into the air so it can come down and rain? And that's a big job, actually. Like, if we had to develop pumps to spray it up in the air, it'd be, we're not up to that engineering task, let's put it that way. But that's what evaporation accomplishes. And evaporation is like a tax on the oceans. It's a tax on the water, in the soil, tax on lakes, rivers. it's even attacks the sweat on the brow of your head, evaporates. And so it's like this, the ultimate tax out there. And you take your cue from that, evaporation occurs from all across the land. Everything is taxed constantly, just a little bit. So this concept of taxing the flow of money, which is maybe better characterized as the payments. Whenever money flows, someone's paying something and someone's being paid. So how many payments are made in our country each year? And that was actually a very difficult number to come by initially.
Mm-hmm. No one else had thought to kind of record that.
Yeah.
You had to do that, thinking of that calculation, how much money flows through the economy every year.
Right. It's... Mm-hmm. And I had a clue it was huge based upon my work on Wall Street. And I was out at dinner one night with a group of traders, and they had a partner in Switzerland. And these three guys, two here in America and one guy in Switzerland, had executed a series of trades. And over drinks, they were just laughing about the prodigious amounts of money they were moving, and they totaled it up. It came to a number that was greater than the gross domestic product of the world.
That's stunning. This was three traders?
Three traders, and this was not Wall Street. This is not on the, not on the New York Stock Exchange, okay? So that's not counted in the figures. The New York Stock Exchange turns out to represent only about 1.5% of the payments in our country. So you're missing the target when you tax income today. You're missing the target when you tax the New York Stock Exchange. The actual volume is $5,000 trillion of payments each year. So that's $5 quadrillion.
$5,000 trillion is the amount of money that changes hands in the United States every year?
Every year. And let me also illustrate what an interesting number that is. Only about 1/3 of 1% of those exchanges, less than 1% of those payments, have anything to do with the economy that you and I would be familiar with. You could literally, this pointed out, you could literally exempt the New York Stock Exchange. You could exempt all retail purchases in our country. You could exempt all the income that any one of us make. You could exempt that. I'm not saying you should, but you could exempt it. And it wouldn't even have an impact on a payments tax.
So what you're talking about, when you're talking about this money moving hands, yes, it includes people getting paid for their work. Yes, it includes people buying stocks on the New York Stock Exchange. And you're saying even all of that together is still just a small amount because so much money is moving all the time. So that would be like every time someone makes a deposit in a bank account, right?
Right.
That's part of,
right.
What else would it include?
Well, I mean, that's a good question. For people to understand the impact of this and where it comes from, that's the exact question. So for an individual, when you sell your house, if you get a check for $300,000 and you've sold your house, that's a payment. And under this plan, 0.2% of that would be deducted, which would be $600. So if you sold your house for $300,000 and you didn't make a gain, under payments tax, you'd still pay $600. If you're earning income and your salary is $100,000, today you're paying between $40,000 to $45,000 in taxes. And with a payments tax, you'd pay $200. So that's a huge tax cut against income taxes on salaries. But if you had the rich uncle died, and he, you got $1 million out of it. you'd pay $2,000. You know, when that money hits your account, $2,000 just comes out automatically, no questions asked. Where the real movement of money is you know, maybe between hedge funds, you've got, you know, they're buying billions of dollars of U.S. treasuries, hundreds of billions of dollars of mortgage-backed securities, foreign exchange trades, commodities being bought and sold, sugar, gold, all of that moving around. In my book, I have a little list of exactly what it is, and we really could not. It's a comforting thought. When you understand this, you begin to think, oh my God, why have we not done this a long time ago? So it's kind of a comforting thought to realize that we didn't have this data up until 5 or 10 years ago. It only really matured about 5 years ago, and it is primarily the responsibility of the Federal Reserve to track most of these payments, not all of them. And that information then, in turn, is reported to sort of a central clearinghouse for this type of information globally, and that's the Bank for International Settlements in Basel, Switzerland. And they turn around and publish an annual publication called the Red Book. And you can go to BIS, for Bank for International Settlements, .org, and you can use their little search engine and look for the Red Book. And there you'll find the Red Book for 2016, 2015, and you can download it, and you can see for yourself the volume of money moving around in the UK and, you know, Canada and most of the major countries in the world, and that's where the data is published for the United States as well.
Yeah. Well, this is just amazing. I mean, to me, this is like the freshest thinking I have ever heard around the whole tax system. So just to summarize it for our listeners here, make sure I'm understanding this right, you're proposing a big shift in how we think about taxes, that right now we tax income is a big source. Mm-hmm. We also have, you know, a sales tax. Mm-hmm. We have an estate tax when people mm-hmm. die. Yeah, you know, I think it's
property
now...
taxes.
Yeah,
property
mm-hmm. taxes, all that. You're saying we can get rid of all of those taxes because where the real mm-hmm. action is in the movement of money itself, mm-hmm. and that if we would put just a very tiny tax, mm-hmm. which you're saying at 0.2%, mm-hmm. As a tax, every time someone gets paid, like you sell a house or you earn some money, you just pay that 0.2%. But because there is so much movement of money that there's a huge volume, and that 0.2% would generate an enormous amount of money available for the federal government to finance our taxes, you know, finance our programs, to finance mm-hmm. Social Security, to pay off the debt, and everything else that we need. Is that a good summary of it?
That's a good summary. And so you're at 0.2%. I'll outline the impact of that. There would be no one paying property taxes anymore. Sales taxes, you go to the grocery store, no sales tax would have to be tacked on anymore. But you don't even realize the impact of excise taxes. So you go to buy a gallon of gas, it would be less money. When you pay your phone bill, it's a large percentage of a phone bill that is an excise tax. I book flights on Frontier, discount airline. $90 flight, $40 of that is taxes. So you could be buying a $50 tag. So you'd be getting rid of these taxes that cost you so much because they are focused on such a minor part of the movement of money in the total economy. We're focused on the wrong thing. So then the consequence of doing that is not only do citizens have a lot more money in their pocket, again, goods and services cost them less because there are no more sales tax or excise taxes. But you literally could afford, and this I'll put it slowly because this is mind-boggling, you literally, at 0.2%, you have all those tax breaks, but you literally could afford to pay every adult citizen in our country $24,000 a year, basic income. And top that off, when they hit 70, you could bump that up to $30,000 a year. Now, that's very simple. That's an across-the-board thing. You're not having to go through all the red tape of welfare, of the Social Security system. You're not keeping track of any of that information. It's just a straight basic income that bumps up at age 70, and you can pull back out of the budget a large percentage of that money. You can eliminate your welfare program, and you can eliminate Social Security. So again, it's injecting efficiency into our government when you do that. You could also pay for free health care, and you could cover the cost of college and under, you know, a very specific program that we've worked on designing. So you don't want to contribute to skyrocketing health care costs, and you don't want to contribute to skyrocketing college. But there's two programs that we've carefully put together that wouldn't do that, and you wouldn't have students piling up the student debt anymore, and you wouldn't have healthcare costs going through the roof anymore.
So you're saying by this shift away from the current taxes of income mm-hmm. and sales and estate taxes and all of it, that we could replace all those taxes with a 0.2% payment tax every time someone gets paid anything.
Mm-hmm. So you get it'd be an automatic feature of the payment system in our country.
Yep.
The Bank for International Settlements, their reason for being, you know, is to oversee and help improve the technology in financial settlements throughout the world. And now they call those payments today. So it's the payment system that exists globally. And mm-hmm. there is a payment system in the United States that is highly regulated, easily controllable, and it would become an automated feature in the payment system. So you wouldn't go about paying a payments tax. You wouldn't file forms. You wouldn't do anything about it. It would be, it's like a credit card. There's a small amount that just comes out for the merchant. And in the payment system, this would be built in. Same thing for blockchain. If blockchain really skyrockets, that's a payment system. That's all blockchain is. And within that system, there would be the legal requirement that 0.2% is shaved off with each transaction. And then you eliminate all those taxes. And so if you talk about privacy, you're no longer having to file tax returns.
Hallelujah. Well, this is a great show
right?
to be having just a month before tax day coming up.
Right? Yeah. Just think about this as we get closer to that dreaded date.
Right.
Let's
I'm going to replay this recording
happen.
On tax day.
Yeah. Let's talk about this again on the 15th.
Absolutely. You're on. So this is one of those things that just sounds so amazing. It's like in the too good to be true category.
Yeah.
But I'm fascinated by it. And when you explain it, and I have read your book, it just makes perfect sense. Really what it is, it's a mind shift away mm-hmm. from kind of the way we've been doing taxes for decades
mm-hmm.
and looking now at the movement of money itself is where a small mm-hmm. tax goes in. So I have several questions for you about this.
Okay.
The first one is you talk rightly about you know, kind of a downside of the proposal of the transaction tax that's been floated mm-hmm. for some time now, recently picked up by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and some others about taxing, you know, transaction tax on when someone buys a stock or a bond, that they pay a transaction tax on that. But you rightly point out that if such a tax were added, people who are involved at these high-level volumes, like the folks you had dinner with, they would just go to a different stock exchange since it's all a global market now. So they could go to London or Tokyo or somewhere else and buy and sell. If when you're looking at the major money, you're talking about, you said the real money is with the hedge funds who buy billions of treasuries and commodities. Like
among them, pension funds.
Among them, yeah.
PE funds, it's sovereign funds. I mean, and then there are it's
so
a whole industry out there.
For us regular people, the amount of payments we would be going yahoo on my $100,000 income. I'm no longer paying $40,000 a year in taxes. I'm paying $200 in tax. That 0.2%.
Right.
So good for us, and it's small enough, it's like we would barely notice it, and like you said, we'd have more money in our pockets, so we're golden. We're happy.
Right.
This is working for us. And on top of that, then we'd probably get this universal basic income, just everybody, every adult gets the $2,000 a month. So so that I can understand, that sounds great. But when you start talking about the people who are buying, you know, making or receiving payments in the billions of dollars.
Who's losing? That's what you're getting to.
Well, it's a combination. Who's losing, and why would they stay here? Like, couldn't they just do those transactions in some other way where they wouldn't be paying the 0.2%? And for them, it would be worth the hassle of going to England or Japan to avoid this payment tax in the U.S.
So that's something that I had to carefully research, because that's the obvious question. And there's two questions. One is there a body of people out there that would be against this? You know, because you go what you're basically looking at is that graph that shows that 1% of the population is controlling, you know, this vast percentage of the assets, and then a tenth of 1% of the population is still controlling this huge number. So you come down to, you know, sometimes people publishing the dozen families that run, you know, almost everything out there.
Right.
And so would they be for something like this? Because they you know, let's not be naive, they wield a lot of power. And so I've had conversations with many of those people. I've met with them and talked to them. So this tax burden is being shifted in that direction. And the key to this working, and it's, I mean, some people are disappointed to hear this, but the key to this working is that even though you've shifted that burden that way, the impact on the economy of having people not having to pay income taxes anymore and the additional spending they're doing, it supercharges the economy to do something like this. And so the rise in asset values because you're doing that is something that those people that really control the bulk of the wealth out there, they also do get wealthier. And so you get the super rich getting richer, you get the middle class doing better, and you get the poor doing better under this program. And that's just a reality of societies as far back as history goes. You know, the key is that at this point in time, you're overburdening the people who are not the super rich with our current tax system. And the net result is there's not sufficient capital in the pockets of the consumer for the economy to run as well as it could. And if you release that, you change that dynamic, and there's more, you know, a lot more money in the hands of the consumer, then the ownership of you know, that infrastructure also does well. So it is a win-win in the end.
Go ahead.
Well, so in shifting the burden, where you shifted the burden, they do better too. So they would win. The second part of your question is, could you avoid this easily? And it's a different, it's a little different, because these assets are, they're owned in the States or they're owned elsewhere. And so you, it's where it's ending up, the ownership, where the payment's ending up is where you're getting taxed. And so that's hard to shift that outside. Plus, there's going to be another impact. I mean, you've got to look at this on a global perspective. If the U.S. implements this, most of the large nations out there can also implement this, and they will. The U.S. is in the most favorable position. That ratio of total payments versus our budget is twice as good of a ratio as it is in Canada and the UK and other areas. But it's still the same effect in those other nations. So a payments tax would become a global standard for the highly developed countries out there.
So you think other countries would pick up on it if the U.S. does this?
Absolutely. I'm in active discussions with other countries on this. I mean, that you know, you read it in another country, you know, first thing they do is pick up the phone.
Mm-hmm.
I get a call and, you know, a group of people in Switzerland saying, how does it work in Switzerland? Yeah. The irony is the Red Book's published right in their country, you know.
That's great. So this is fascinating to me. You have already spoken to some of these 1%ers, the people who are the most wealthy. I don't know what the current is. The top 1% owns more wealth than the bottom 90% together or something ridiculous like that.
Right.
Your argument to them is, look, yes, the middle class and the poor will do better under this plan, but you will too, because once we get more money into the hands of the middle class and the poor through cutting their taxes and giving them this $2,000 a month kind of a universal basic income every month, that when you put money in the hands of people who have less of it, they're going to go out and spend it. They're going to buy a refrigerator. They'll buy a new car. Mm-hmm. They're going to take that money and it'll pump up the economy. I mean, as opposed to what Trump did and the tax bill we had in December 2017, which was more of the vacuum cleaner of more of the money being sucked out of the middle class and going up to the corporations and the already wealthy. Is like, that doesn't stimulate the economy so much because they already have three yachts or whatever it is that they want.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the billionaires have everything they already want already. So I see your argument that the stimulus, put the money in the hands of the poor and the middle class, and they're going to spend it. So you're saying the whole pie is going to increase. So the 1% will go, well, yeah, I might be paying more on this 0.2% payment tax, but I'm going to more than make up for it because the whole economy is going to be stimulated so much that I'll be making more money even with the payment tax I'm paying.
That's correct. In economics, sort of the formal term of that is it's the indexing effect, so that these securities that exist out there, they're synthetic in a certain way. They're all indexed back down to the reality of the economy in a way. And so you get a multiplicative effect. So if you've got, $1 trillion of stimulus in terms of GDP, you're going to have a trillion times, you know, it's going to be, it goes at different levels. It'll have a 5X effect, you know, right at, say, the stock market, but then it goes into multiple effect in the synthetic securities. So they get richer. we get richer, they get even richer. That's the reality of it. But it's that's what keeps it from being too good to be true.
Right. Well, I'm fine with the 1% making more money. I love prosperity. I love that people are enormously wealthy. You know, my thing is I want everyone to be wealthy. I don't want anyone in this country, no child should go hungry. I want every person to have the food and the shelter and the quality education and the some initial capital to kind of start a business if that's what they want to do. I want to make sure everyone has the chance to live up to their potential and follow their dreams and follow their destiny, what they want to create. And I'm fine. If we have that for everybody, then it's okay for me if, you know, Jeff Bezos has $113 billion. You know, I'm not against wealth. What I'm against is having so many people or so few people so wealthy that, you know, some people are going hungry and some people can't afford an education. And we get 40%.
It's our current, right, it's our current system. But you're touching on an interesting point. It isn't really the fact that the wealthy are so wealthy that makes the poor poor. What it is our current system is working against itself. It's working against everyone in that regard. And so under this series of proposals that we're making, which collectively what we're thinking about is we would... You know, I'm in the process now through our foundation of working with law firms in D.C. to draft the model bill that this would, you know, that would put this in place. And we would call it the Freedom Bill. So under the Freedom Bill, you have a reset to the basic operating system of the economy so that the poor are actually able to move upward, and then the people that own the factories and all that, they do better today too, because the number one problem of businesses is there's not enough money in the hands of the consumer. And if you look at, you know, the irony of the last tax cut is the same irony of quantitative easing. So here you have had a Democratic administration, and under quantitative easing, $85 billion a month was being pumped into the coffers of corporate America, and you know, those are liberals. And then under now a Republican administration, the tax cut comes about, and the recipient was corporate America again. It didn't help the average guy, the consumer. And this plan does help the average guy and the consumer. And the irony of this is that that would actually help corporate America much more than the stimulus that they've received under these other two administrations. So we all do better, you know.
Yeah. No, I like
that. We all do better.
I'm tracking your argument. I see it, and I'm wondering when you talked to the members of the 1% and you made this case with them, what did they say to you?
I didn't have to argue it. I mean, this is
they
a bright bunch of people. They got it right away. I said, I just want to, I mean, I post it each time I had a meeting. I post it just simply, am I missing something here? Because the way I would model this, you guys are going to do incredibly well with this, you know. But look what's going to happen in society. Do you see any holes in this? And no, you're absolutely right. This is what we should do. So
you're getting a positive response.
Oh, very, very positive response. Very positive response. And I'm going out to New York next week to meet with more of these people. And it's like, how do we make this happen? So it would not happen. You know, the challenge is if you're going to come in with some system that helps, you know, a certain group of people, and you are flying in the face of the powers that be, you're going to have resistance. But when you are actually all in sync, you're not going to have the resistance. And so from the beginning, everything I worked on, I looked at it from that reality. And this is an advantage of being somebody who's neutral. I'm not a Democrat and I'm not a Republican. I'm an independent. And I think the divide between the parties right now is completely holding us back to getting real solutions. Everybody's spending 99% of their time on bogus arguments and talking about things that they don't even know what they're talking about, you know. And the truth is that the core values, at least that used to be behind the parties, and I'd like to think they're still there, those are good values. There was no reason to compromise any of those values to arrive at a good solution. Our budget should be balanced. I feel that as strongly as any conservative in the past. We should be paying off our debt. Under the Freedom Bill, our entire national debt could be paid off inside 10 years. Under the current approach, we're adding to our debt. I'd call out the Heritage Foundation. On their website, they say the president's budget is going to chip away at the debt. It's not. It's not chipping away the debt. The debt is still going up. I would like the president to put forth a budget that chipped away the debt. This program would not just chip away the debt, but it would get rid of the debt inside of 10 years without austerity. So yeah. That's the type of solution you need. You know, on the liberal side, are we supposed to take care of the poor? Yes, we are, but under the welfare system, we are not taking care of the poor. When you have people on welfare, and if they are to go out and get a job, and for every $10 they earn, you're going to take away more than $10 in benefits. It's like you've created the welfare trap. Basic income changes that entire paradigm over. In fact, under our Freedom Plan, we have an earned income credit component that goes hand in hand with basic income, because you still do need people to work, even though automation is going to probably change that over time. You want to marry basic income with incentives so that if a person who is unemployed now gets the basic income, but then they get a job at 10 grand, they get a credit on top of that. Mm-hmm. And so you can really change these solutions that are addressing issues that are so damaging in our economy today.
Right. So what you're proposing is revolutionary. I mean, you're saying let's get rid of pretty much all our current methods of taxation, whether that's your income tax or your sales tax or the estate tax. Get rid of all of them and replace it with this 0.2% tax on any payment that's made. So, it's a radical change, and I'm wondering, is there any way to phase this in stages? You know, because I find it hard to believe that, you know, we would wipe out all the taxes and then try this, and if this doesn't work out, like the country collapses. So, right. Is there a way to try it out in a city or a state or some smaller locale, or introduce some small aspect of a payment tax on just bank deposits, or some way to phase this in instead of a wrenching shift overnight?
Absolutely. There's easy ways to do it. There are ways you can't do it, too. You can't start it on a local basis, and you can't do it on a state basis, because payments are not geographic in that sense. They're geographic in a sovereign sense, but a lot more payments flow through Illinois than flow through, say, Wyoming, for example. The payments that are flowing in Illinois might be really for Alabama or for another state. So you can't do it regionally or locally, but you could phase in any number of ways it could be faced. And one way we've looked at is maybe just pick FICA taxes as an example for Social Security. That's a hot spot right now. You know, we're going to have to save Social Security. So you could do a very tiny payments tax and have that going straight to Social Security. Phase out FICA as you build that up. And as you're seeing it's happening and it's working, then you can pick up steam. So there's ways to test this hypothesis. There's ways to phase it in without upsetting the system. And yet, let me also point out something. And if you look at what we're doing under the Freedom Bill, I'm very much a systems engineer. And so there are ways to use the existing system. You're not going to have new divisions in the government. You're not going to have complex changes in order to do this. The tax code that would be necessary for a payments tax probably is going to end up being 10 to 20 pages total. You contrast that to the 77,000 pages in our existing tax code. It's way easier to do this. You're utilizing the existing system that we've built up, and you're making simple systemic changes. That's the same, you know, same case all the way through in our plan for medical care or health care and in college. It's, again, not ripping out the existing system, but allowing something else that grows up organically next to the system. So that's a key for change. For large-scale change, you have to have it fit within existing systems and grow organically. And if you look at what we've done in society over the last 10, 20, and 30 years in terms of the Internet, in terms of, you know, automated cars, flying cars coming down the pike, the amount of change that has occurred and will occur is enormous. And when you contrast this to that, it's actually going to be fairly easy, Eleanor, if we follow the recipe we've been developing.
Yeah, well, I'm much relieved to hear you talking about allowing this to grow up organically next to the existing system. I can see that if we start with the 0.2% tax on any payments made and start generating that revenue, that as that revenue gets generated, then once it's in the coffers, we'd say, okay, now we can stop the income tax, or now we can stop the estate.
We'd probably have to do something way less than the 0.2. That's turning on a fire hose.
Okay, so we start with 0.1%.
So it's even better news than you're thinking.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, I'm for transformation, and I want it done in a way that doesn't wrench and dislocate people. And sometimes you have a good idea and then something comes up you hadn't thought about. So I love this idea of it growing up organically and maybe starts like stage one, stage two, you know, the different stages to show that it works, and as it's working then to let the other ones go. Very sensible.
It's very feasible. Yeah.
Yep. And I want to circle back to something you said early in this conversation, which is that we tend to think that the way things are the way they have always been. And clearly that's not true, and that the tax base has changed. I mean, we didn't have an income tax until, was it 1913?
1913.
So talk a little bit about how our tax system has changed over time, and this is like next generation of tax change as opposed to it has forever been this way and now this is like a whole new thing. No, this is just like another one of changes that have happened with our method of taxing.
Absolutely. It's just the only anomaly you would see maybe 100 years from now looking back is they had, you know, 1913 came. It was just one more change, and then they had this gap for a while, you know, where they weren't making changes, but yet their economy was changing. So before 1913, it was alcohol and tobacco, and that provided 80% of our revenue. And let's say we had stopped then, and we didn't have the change in 1913 for income tax. Alcohol and tobacco wouldn't provide for maybe 5% of the revenue that we need today. And so you would have people saying, why the government is 20 times larger than it can afford to be. It's 20 times too big. It's like, no, you're just taxing the wrong thing if you're depending on alcohol and tobacco. Prior to that, there were taxes on cotton, on sugar. We used to tax material, finished goods coming in from Europe when we were, you know, in the early days. And so there was always the 900-pound gorilla to tax in the economy. And income was the right thing in 1913 because you had Henry Ford out there paying $5 an hour, which would, you know, it's probably like $100 an hour today. I don't know the exact number, but it was an unheard of wage. And you had automation coming into the factories, and you had factories coming into being in the and that new way of producing things. The worker was way more efficient with all the tools that we were developing, and so workers were getting paid more, and that was what developed the middle class in our country. And so income taxes was the right thing back then. But where the real change began to occur was in the 50s and 60s. We became much more productive coming off of World War II. And in the 1970s, we saw a really big change, which heralded the need to get rid of income taxes. And that was that income began to flatten out. So in the 1970s through now, when you do corrected dollars for inflation, income has been basically flat. And the reason for that is the same automation that caused it to rise. But it began to obsolete the worker instead of augmenting what the worker could do. And that,
well,
the flagship of that.
Well, it's also policy changes so that the increased productivity that there was flowing to the owners, not to the workers.
There was some that contributes to it, too. And so you have a system in which production, put a broad name on it, is being trivialized through technology. And the guys who are actually putting all these factories together and building that technology, they probably cringe when they hear me say that, saying trivialized. You don't know how hard we work on it. But the fact of the matter is, for society, the ability to produce more cars and doing that is not the challenge. If you went to GM and said, I don't understand, you want to grow your profit, why don't you just make twice as many cars, you know? Their response to that is, we don't have the buyers. You know, there aren't the consumers. There's not the consumer base out there to buy it. And so as we've relied on taxing income and yet wages have flattened out, we have created a very dangerous self-defeating little cycle there that gets worse and worse. And that is where the wealth divide comes from. That is where the collapse of the middle class comes from. It is a systemic problem in our economy that is fairly easy to correct. And when corrected, you'll have the birth of a growing middle class again, and you're going to have, the irony it is, you're going to have a lot more jobs because of the stimulation, and you're going to have an environment that is highly conducive for the entrepreneurial spirit in our country. We are kind of like, it's like we've been held back by our old operating system. Technology is trying to drive us forward, and our archaic system has been holding us back. And when we modernize that, we're going to spring forward, and it's going to be, the potential out there is spectacular. We just need the right operating system to capture that potential.
Well said. Well, that's about all the time we have, and it's a fascinating idea. I so applaud you for your creative thinking, and for our listeners, I encourage you to read the book. It's The New Operating System for the American Economy. Instead of paying taxes, you would receive dividends, kind of like Alaska does from the oil now. But I look forward to tracking your progress. That's all the time we have for now. Scott Smith, thank you so much for being on All Together Now.
Well, thank you, Eleanor. It was my pleasure.
In case you've missed any of our programs, they're available in the archives. Our theme song is Let's Give Them Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. I'll be back next Thursday. Thanks for joining us. This is Eleanor LaCane with All Together Now.